This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Firing people, shutting down servers, the corporate legacy of Edward Snowden. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, August 9th. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. Like many people getting out of town before vacation, the president left an unpleasant task, facing the press, to the last minute. And that included talking about NSA leaker Edward Snowden.
We have to strike the right balance between protecting our security and preserving our freedoms. And as part of this rebalancing, I called for a review of our surveillance programs.
Well, rebalancing is something governments and companies all over the world are doing. The NSA itself is firing most of its systems administrators. Call it the Snowden effect. Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
It's not just the NSA that's downsizing as a result of the Snowden effect. Take, for example, Silent Circle, a private encryption company. Phil Zimmerman is the co-founder.
We encrypt the text messages. We encrypt the phone calls. If you need to whisper in someone's ear from 1,000 miles away, we can help you with that.
Zimmerman says that when it comes to email encryption, he no longer feels comfortable offering the same privacy guarantees that he did before the government surveillance program, PRISM. So the company shut down that service. So did another encryption company, LavaBit.
They said, we aren't willing to do something, but we can't tell you what it is we weren't willing to do. And there's these gag orders that these companies are under.
Daniel Castro is with the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. It just released a study that said the U.S. cloud computing industry could lose up to $35 billion as a result of the NSA surveillance programs like PRISM.
Over the past few years, there's been a lot of concern in a number of countries about the U.S. dominance in this industry.
Even before Snowden's big reveal, foreign companies were pushing for a larger share of the data storage business, which is expected to reach $207 billion by 2016. Now those foreign companies have an effective new marketing slogan, "We won't spy on you." But the U.S. has bigger problems.
We've seen a German Minister of Justice call for an outright ban on U.S. companies providing data-related services.
Executives from Apple, Google, AT&T, and members from civil liberties groups all voiced their concerns personally with President Obama in a hush-hush meeting yesterday. In his speech today, he said government will take steps to increase oversight and transparency in all government surveillance programs. But he didn't say anything about doing any less of that surveillance. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Hey, maybe William Shatner negotiated a higher stock price. Shares of Priceline.com, which has Shatner as a spokesman, are now close to $1,000. The last time they flew this high was back in April of 1999, and just 18 months later, they crashed at $1.31. So it's a pretty remarkable resurrection. Sarah McCammon looks at how Priceline bounced back.
If you think Priceline is just a cute little website where William Shatner helps you find a cheap plane ticket, think again. It's the second largest travel company in the world.
It's a very underappreciated fact.
Rafat Ali is the CEO of the travel industry website Skift.
When you tell this to people, their minds usually tend to get blown.
It almost wasn't that way. Henry Blodgett is the editor of Business Insider and a former stock analyst. He says the company went public to tremendous hype at the height of the dot-com boom.
And then completely collapsed, down 99%. And pretty much everybody wrote the company off for dead.
But it's back, Blodgett says, thanks to careful management and smart investments.
They have just been quietly putting up the numbers, quarter after quarter for the last 5 to 10 years, and that's what's delivered it.
Priceline recently bought the travel site Kayak. It also owns rentalcars.com and the hotel site booking.com. Rafat Ali of Skift says that's a major reason for Priceline's success.
The secret in the travel industry is that airline bookings make no money. Hotels is where the money is made.
Scott Kessler is an equity analyst with S&P Capital IQ. He says this is being called the most remarkable turnaround in the history of the Internet.
And I think that's a fair characterization in many respects. The stock actually over the last 10 years has risen more than 3,000%.
Analysts say there's still room for Priceline to grow. I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, all three indices finished down, their worst week since June. Details when we do the numbers. It's Friday. That's when we do 4 minutes of live business news analysis we call the Weekly Wrap. Joining me today are Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal and Catherine Rampell from The New York Times. Hey, guys.
Hey, Lizzie.
Hey, Lizzie.
So I want to start with the president and whether he tipped his hand about who he wants to run the Fed. Let's listen.
I have a range of outstanding candidates. You've mentioned two of them, Mr. Summers and Mr. Yellen, Ms. Yellen.
Mr. Yellen, what happened there? Catherine, you go first.
I think it's an unfortunate slip of the tongue, especially given a lot of the discussion about how gender has influenced perceptions of the two candidates. I don't know that it necessarily means anything about any new information about which candidate he might be leaning toward. The general perception seems to be that Larry Summers is the front runner, but I'm a little hesitant to read the tea leaves too much into this Freudian slip.
Sudeep, am I crazy? Is it a Freudian slip or, you know, is Summers this guy?
I actually thought President Obama was working very hard not to make any news during that press conference about the Fed chairman. So he was trying to avoid getting into that. So he obviously forgot some of the basics, including the gender of one of his leading candidates. But the most important issue here is Janet Yellen is the safe choice for the Fed chairmanship. Larry Summers is certainly an incredibly smart economist, but investors don't know much, if anything, about his monetary policy views. And so that's the thing that President Obama is going to have to weigh in the coming weeks, because the understanding of investors of these two officials is going to matter a lot if we ever normalize Fed policy in the coming years, because that's going to be a really important, critical part of getting out of this mess.
Catherine, are we at a point where this big food fight over the Fed might actually start to concern the markets?
I think the markets are already concerned. I mean, you've seen a lot of activity in the last couple of months over guesswork as to when the Fed will begin to taper its asset purchases. Again, a lot of reading of the tea leaves, a different set of tea leaves in this case. And it's possible that the Fed choice that Obama has coming could affect the markets in that respect. But again, that's still Bernanke's decision at this point, given that he has said that Fed policy on tapering would come later this year, which would still be under his purview.
Sudeep, let's move to the investigation into J.P. Morgan and that great big bet they made, the London Whale $6 billion trade. It looks like the trader may not be charged, but that J.P. Morgan could have to admit some responsibility here. That seems like a big change in the way banks are being maybe investigated by the government.
It certainly would be. When we've seen investigations in the past, banks, any firms, companies get to usually make a settlement by saying they neither admit nor deny wrongdoing. J.P. Morgan, if it were to admit that it was wrong, just say in some way that it was wrong in a formal investigation settlement, that would be a big step. Now, Jamie Dimon, the head of the bank, has already made some of these acknowledgments. But there's a bigger issue here that we hope that the government will get into is how do we know in real time that these big banks, our biggest financial institutions, aren't making disastrous bets that will bring down parts of the financial system. And that's the really critical issue that we have to get into.
All right, Catherine, we're running out of time, but I want to know, are Fannie and Freddie really going away? The president said, get rid of them.
Well, that's not exactly what the president said.
Privatized them.
He said that the private sector should be the main backbone for the for lending in the mortgage market, but he still said that the federal government has a role to backstop that. And he's praised a Senate bill that would basically have the government still serve as some sort of reinsurer of some mortgage-backed securities, potentially charging for that service, but in a very scaled-down model. So it's not as if the federal government, if that's what you mean by you know, the government-sponsored entities, Fannie and Freddie, which are now run by the federal government, it's not as if that those are going to, that's going to disappear entirely from the housing market.
All right, Catherine Rampell, Sudeep Reddy, thanks so much for joining me, guys.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thanks.
Here in Los Angeles, if you try to drive near a Dodgers game these days, it's absolute madness. Fans are pouring into the stadium. Guys are out on the street hawking jerseys. At one player's jersey in particular, rookie outfielder Yasiel Puig. KPCC's Ben Bergman reports on how marketers are working on turning Puig mania into money.
Last year, the Dodgers signed Yasiel Puig to a $42 million contract without ever seeing him play in a game. The strong consensus among baseball executives and writers, the Dodgers had wildly overpaid.
I don't believe it! A grand slam home run!
When Puig finally got his chance in the majors, he didn't waste any time proving the doubters wrong. Thanks largely to Puig, Dodgers tickets are a hot commodity for the first time in years. Their TV ratings are up 6% since mid-June, and Puig's jersey is one of the highest-selling in baseball.
Everything gravitates towards him. You know, he's outgoing, he's extremely likable, good-looking kid with a million-dollar smile.
That's Alex Radetzky, whose job it will be to turn that million-dollar smile into multi-million-dollar endorsements. Radetzky beat out many others, including the rapper Jay-Z, to be Puig's new marketing agent.
We didn't say that we want to strike right now when things are hot. That'd probably be misleading because you certainly want to make sure you don't miss out on some opportunities.
But companies looking to sign Puig might not be in such a hurry. Bill Glenn is senior vice president of advertising firm The Marketing Arm.
Well, if I was a brand looking at him, yeah, I'd probably wait. At least I personally look at this as more like his 15 minutes of fame.
And there are other reasons to wait. Puig can be aloof off the field. Much of his background remains a mystery. He rarely grants interviews, and when he does, they're in Spanish. Still, longtime talent agent Mark Perman calls Yasiel Puig's marketing prospects enormous if the Dodger outfielder continues to drive in runs. But he says there's a common misconception that agents' phones are ringing off the hook.
You don't necessarily have 20 companies calling you. It isn't like it's such a seller's market that you're turning down really, really good deals.
Player salaries keep going up, but Perman says they're making less off the field. That's because companies aren't spending like they used to on endorsement deals, which is bad news for Puig.
He's not going to be playing in the same sandbox that players in the 90s did, for example, which was probably the peak of this whole business.
Perman says the fast-growing Hispanic market still isn't big enough to have much of an impact on Puig's deals, and there's some evidence his heritage could actually hurt him with marketers. ESPN recently commissioned a study looking at the top 125 richest athletes. Hispanic stars made, on average, about 40% less endorsement money as everyone else. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bergman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger.
How will it all end for Walter White? It's the final season of Breaking Bad. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street just couldn't hang in there. The Dow Jones Industrial Average knocked off 72 points, 0.4%, to close at 15,425. The NASDAQ lost 9 points, or 0.25%, ending at 3660. The S&P 500 lost 6 points, 0.33%, landing at 1691. For the week, the Dow dropped 1.5%, the NASDAQ fell 0.8%, and the S&P 500 0.1%. Stronger demand from China lifted mining shares, Cliffs Natural Resources shot up 10%, Freeport-McMoRan added 2.5%. Bond prices were fat. The yield on the 10-year T-note held steady at 2.58%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department issues its monthly statement for July. 8,000 people are expected in Washington for a conference on unmanned systems. It's robot stuff. And major excuse to sneak out and stay up past curfew. The sky fills with shooting stars when the Perseid meteor shower is at its peak. Make a wish. Heck, make do. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. Maybe you've put a little money into a Kickstarter, donating online to fund somebody's creative project, a movie, an art exhibit, that kind of thing. But so far, getting investments directly from the public hasn't been an option for small companies. The Jobs Act was supposed to fix that, but Washington has been slow to make it happen. So some states are going ahead on their own. Jim Burris reports on what's called equity crowdfunding.
Sean Lee gets crowdfunding. Without Kickstarter, he might not be in this industrial loft near downtown Atlanta turning oil cans into $300 electric guitars.
Since the body is metal, not only are you picking up stuff from the strings, you're picking up stuff from the can as well. So just from it like rubbing up against your body, just you get like a really unique tone.
A few years ago, Sean and his brother Adam noticed this unique tone coming from a street musician in their native South Africa. They brought an oil can guitar back to Atlanta. Lots of folks started asking where they could get one. So Adam says it seemed logical to start a business. They named it Bohemian Guitars.
And over time, the demand grew and grew and grew, and we realized we were onto something special here.
But they burned through the original $55,000 raised from Kickstarter. And banks have said no for loans big and small. Bohemian Guitars needs $150,000 to expand. To get that, the brothers are poised to test a new kind of crowdfunding. They'll sell shares to fellow Georgians. That's not as easy as it sounds. To curb fraud during the Great Depression, Washington banned private companies from soliciting investment from the general public. Since then, only wealthy people have been able to buy shares of firms not listed on a stock exchange. Last year's Jobs Act was supposed to change that, but the SEC is still deciding on rules for ordinary investors. Georgia already has a fix.
We passed this rule in 2011. I kept wondering who was going to catch on to it.
The rule Vincent Russo is talking about is the Invest Georgia exemption. Russo is general counsel for the Georgia Secretary of State. He says federal law allows states to regulate commerce inside their borders. Georgia's exemption lets small, local firms raise up to $1 million by selling shares to state residents.
You should be able to invest your money and get a return on local projects that you believe in.
Megan Johnson is a lawyer-turned-entrepreneur. We spoke outside a deserted Atlanta storefront where a failed effort to bring in a business sparked her interest in crowdfunding.
The fact that our archaic security laws have prevented that from being a possibility is crazy.
Johnson and business partner Jeff Bacarius were among the earliest to spot the crowdfunding potential in Georgia's exemption. Now, they're about to launch Spark Market, an online service to link startups with equity investors. Bacaria says Bohemian Guitars is Spark Market's first customer.
There are no crowdfunding experts. There are only crowdfunding enthusiasts, and that's what Spark Market is. And we're learning and growing together from that point.
They anticipate growing pains along the way, like competition. Another Georgia site is already up and running. Then there's convincing locals to buy in, despite concerns about fraud. Johnson says investors should understand there are other risks.
A lot of the businesses that will ultimately seek raises through Spark Market will be new and untested business models.
Like crowdfunding itself. Georgia followed Kansas into this market. North Carolina and Washington State are also considering crowdfunding laws. Adam Lee believes Bohemian Guitars will validate the concept and send a message to big financiers who now snub his company.
It's not something that they see as a long-term investment, and we're going to prove everyone wrong.
And on the eve of offering shares, Bohemian just landed Urban Outfitters as its biggest customer yet. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
It's a summer weekend when Hollywood likes to drop a new movie. This year, big-budget dystopian fantasy seems to be everywhere. White House Down, Olympus Has Fallen, After Earth. Well, the new one is Elysium, out in theaters today, where the wealthy have left everyone else on Earth and decamped to disease, poverty, and immigrant-free Elysium. Wesley Morris writes for Grantland and talks about movies with us. Thanks for coming on the show.
Nice to talk to you.
This movie teases out some big questions about wealth, poverty, immigration. Explain those to me a little bit.
The 1%, which appears to be in this film, all the white people, have gone to a satellite planet where Jodie Foster is the defense secretary and wants to keep any Los Angelinos or anybody from Earth, those poor, dirty Earthlings, from entering her airspace. So she happily just sends missiles to shoot them down.
I mean, this sounds like it is spinning out the divide between the 1% and the 99% to tremendous extremes.
Actually, it is in some ways, but it doesn't really go far enough, to be honest with you. It has to sort of make people feel good about something that is inherently unsolvable and kind of a downer, right? Inequality, injustice, social and economic injustice, and this idea that the chasm between who people who have and people who don't have is growing so wide. This movie takes it to farcical proportions, where the people who have enough to buy a planet where they don't have to live with people who don't have anything. So you're the only white guy on Earth saving all the sort of remaining brown people by taking on the white people of this man-made satellite.
I was going to ask you about that. I'm curious about this great white savior dynamic that they've set up.
Well, I mean, commercially, I think I understand it. It's sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. This movie wants to be a movie about racial injustice and socioeconomic injustice, but it sort of has to sort of, it can't happen unless you have basically a white star.
Neil Blomkamp, who directed Elysium, does not like the comparisons to Occupy Wall Street and people saying, you've created this semi-socialist allegory. And yet, a lot of these themes are in this movie.
I think that Blomkamp is sort of, his agitation over people sort of saying this is some kind of allegory seems a little misplaced. He said it in 2154, and for as much as he wants to say that this movie is about now, which it so clearly is, it also sort of uses the freedoms and liberties of science fiction to sort of make these larger points.
As social criticism, does it work?
I think it's saying a lot of different things. I don't think it's saying any one particular thing in an interesting way. I think that this idea of white flight, of literal white flight, where like the whites have like flown to some planet that they created for themselves, is a very compelling idea. It's totally obvious, but its literalism is actually kind of beautiful in some way.
Wesley Morris of Grantland, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Elysium doesn't have the market cornered on dark worldviews this weekend. The fifth and final season of Breaking Bad starts Sunday, when I will be glued to my TV. For you non-fans out there, the show centers on Walter White, a chemistry teacher who becomes a ruthless meth dealer. The series has made a lot of money for cable network AMC, which reported another profitable quarter yesterday. It's also become a lesson in the future of television, where the show never stops. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
At the Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria, New York, Breaking Bad fans can get up close to the briefs Walter White wore when he cooked his first batch of meth, and the famous green shirt he dons is Heisenberg, his drug alias. They're part of an exhibit on the show that opened last month ahead of the new season. Barbara Miller is the curator.
The story that we wanted to tell about Breaking Bad was really about the transformation of the Walter White character.
The transformation of a Nebushi High School chemistry teacher into an international drug lord.
I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger.
Just as White mixes chemicals to cook up something incredibly addictive, the AMC cable network has created its own formula to make the show all the more addictive. Charlie Collier is the president of AMC.
We do a lot, both on air and off, to give the fans access to their shows.
Things like live webcasts with the actors and writers and marathon screenings of past episodes ahead of the new season opener. Then there's the second screen experience where viewers can follow tweets and use a Breaking Bad app during the show.
Literally, if you watch the second screen while you're watching the show, you get other information and get to go deeper into some of the behind-the-scenes elements of Breaking Bad.
Then there's the post-game. After each episode, another show called Talking Bad lets viewers continue their online conversations on air, asking questions of actors and celebrity fans. Sam Ford is co-author of Spreadable Media. He says Breaking Bad is indicative of a larger movement throughout TV.
To deepen engagement and conversation with their audiences.
Shows like HBO's Game of Thrones have live video chats with actors during the offseason. Producers of True Blood sent copies of ancient texts to bloggers to decode ahead of the season premiere.
Eventually the question gets raised as to what is the series.
That new media blurring of the lines is in part designed for a very old-fashioned goal, getting people to watch in real time.
A lot of these are also strategies to combat shifted viewing.
To keep people from watching later when they can fast-forward through the commercials.
To fit the show back into the logic that the television industry was traditionally built on.
A logic where you watch the ads and the network makes money, or you buy it on iTunes or pay to see it on Netflix.
Chemistry is the study of matter, but I prefer to see it as the study of change. That's all of life.
And that's the TV business, too. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Sabri had a long conversation with the president of AMC about this season of Breaking Bad and what the network plans to do after the show wraps. You can hear the full interview at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
Our final note today is about Detroit. We've talked a lot about it on this show. Still a lot of questions about how the city gets out of bankruptcy. Well, here's another peek into Detroit's dysfunction. It turns out that earlier this year, the city, wait for it, lost a $1 million check. The school system sent the check to the city. It got stuck in a drawer at City Hall and didn't turn up for a month. And no, they couldn't just wire the money because Detroit doesn't have the technology to do that. Its financial systems are about 30 years out of date. Another thing that needs to get fixed. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Satara Nieves. And the executive producer is Deborah Clark. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.